This is Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. We're now accepting submissions for our Neurology Education Journal. This is a peer-reviewed journal focused on neurologic and neuroscience education research. Go to npub.org/NE for details. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Hello, this is Hallie Alexander with the Neurology Podcast. Today I'm speaking with Shobi Sivathambu from Monash University in Australia about her recent paper in neurology titled Serious Cardiac Arrhythmias Detected by Subcutaneous Long-Term Cardiac Monitors in Patients with Drug-Resistant Epilepsy. Shobi, welcome to the podcast and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Hallie.
So in this study, you performed cardiac monitoring for a minimum of 12 months in patients who had refractory epilepsy, but they otherwise did not have any significant cardiac history or significant risk factors for arrhythmia. And there were some really striking findings in your study, but let's just dig right in to have you tell us what the implications are of these findings in terms of the general care of epilepsy patients. So who should we be monitoring for cardiac arrhythmias or conduction issues?
We found that of the patients with poorly controlled epilepsy, clinically significant cardiac arrhythmias tended to occur in both tonic-clonic as well as focal impaired awareness seizures. In the case of the patient with prolonged ictal asystole, the patient had temporal lobe epilepsy, which is consistent with what we know from the previous literature, where about 90% of all cases of ictal asystole tend to occur in patients with temporal lobe epilepsy. Bradyarrhythmias might be more common in temporal lobe epilepsy, as this likely involves seizure involvement of temporal brain regions underlying cardiac control of depressor responses, such as the hippocampus, amygdala, and insula. Post-ictal cardiac arrhythmias, on the other hand, tend to carry a higher mortality risk. Elevated post-ictal sympathetic activity and catecholamines during and following tonic-clonic seizures may make cardiac arrhythmias, such as the polymorphic ventricular tachycardia seen in our study, more likely. So cardiac monitoring in this sort of period is critical. Almost half of the patients in our study also had cardiac conduction abnormalities, which might be from the hypoxic effects of repeated seizures over time, which could lead to cardiac fibrosis and remodeling. But reassuringly, these changes were not found to be of clinical significance. Given that this was a relatively small sample size, this still is an invasive procedure, though a very minor one and very low risk. We still need to better understand risk factors to identify which patients would benefit the most from long-term cardiac monitoring.
So it's interesting that, like you said, half the patients had conduction abnormalities, and you did see at least three patients who had clinically significant arrhythmias. So the question is, should we monitor patients routinely? And if so, how long do we need to monitor them for? For example, in your study, you know, you monitored them at least 12 months. You know, so if we did a 2-week Zio patch, is that going to be enough to find anything?
There's not enough evidence to suggest that we should be monitoring everyone routinely. But as we identify risk factors, we can stratify those who would benefit most from this sort of monitoring. Based on our study, I'd recommend monitoring for up to 12 months, which was the time taken for the first detection of clinically significant cardiac arrhythmias for all patients with recurrent symptoms. So one of our patients had an isolated case of asystole at the 26-month mark, but we didn't actually see that again. And cardiac monitors can be left in safely for up to 3 years. Newer generation monitors are quite easy to insert and remove, and are also 3T MRI compatible. So cardiac monitoring can be performed alongside concurrent epilepsy investigations, such as those for epilepsy surgery.
I think you bring up a good point, because even if we aren't necessarily to the point where we should be monitoring everyone routinely as an outpatient, it sounds like doing the monitoring when they're inpatient, for example, for a surgical workup, that it probably does make sense to have all patients on telemetry in order to detect some of these periectal arrhythmias. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. So I think concurrent to EEG and ECG monitoring is the most useful by far. I think routine 12-lead ECGs have an important role and can identify those who might have structural or genetic cardiac abnormalities early on into their diagnosis. So that can be useful and it's relatively low risk and non-invasive. But I think for the majority of patients, video EEG monitoring with ECG and EEG is going to be most useful. Having said that, most of our patients also had that, and they had at least one electroclinical seizure captured during video EEG monitoring, and yet these cardiac arrhythmias still went undiagnosed from those investigations, suggesting that this is more complicated than we understand at the moment.
Yeah, that's what I found to be the scariest thing in your study is that these arrhythmias and conduction abnormalities that you detected pretty much otherwise would not have ever been detected. It was only because you did the extended monitoring that you found them, and that's a little bit scary. So, what other results did you find in your study?
I think by far the most interesting finding for us is the recurrent non-sustained polymorphic ventricular in the patient with an epileptic encephalopathy. So we know that polymorphic ventricular tachycardia is a very malignant ventricular tachyarrhythmia. It can sometimes spontaneously revert back to sinus rhythm, but it often causes syncope if it persists for more than a few seconds. And sometimes it can deteriorate to ventricular fibrillation, which can lead to cardiac arrest. In our patient, this sometimes occurred in the context of fever, along with his tonic-clonic seizures, but this wasn't always the case, likely suggesting more complex and heterogeneous mechanisms. His subsequent cardiology investigations, including an echocardiogram and stress test, were all normal. He was subsequently trialed on the ketogenic diet, which thankfully reduced his seizure burden. But epileptic encephalopathies are a group that we don't really know a lot about in terms of cardiac risk factors. Dravet syndrome, for example, appears to confer a high risk of sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, but the mechanisms for death in this population might be different to what we see in other cases of SUDEP. Common genetic factors in this population, such as those that encode sodium channel function, may contribute towards a combined risk of cardiac dysfunction and epilepsy, as well as SUDEP in this population.
So there's really a lot more work that kind of needs to be done in this area, like you said. Now, I know this is a very timely study that you've done because there's been a lot of interest in effects of sodium channel blocking anti-seizure medications on cardiac arrhythmias and cardiac conduction abnormalities, for example, lamotrigine, carbamazepine, lacosamide, pretty much all the sodium channel blocking medications. So did you see any association with use of sodium channel blockers and the arrhythmias or conduction abnormalities that you found in your study?
Unfortunately, one that's not easily answered. In our study, most participants were on sodium channel blockers, so we weren't able to test this hypothesis. In the literature, there isn't compelling evidence for acute cardiac arrhythmias in the setting of sodium channel medications, except when administered intravenously or given at high doses. And even despite all of that, this almost always occurs in high-risk populations, such as the elderly or those with underlying cardiovascular disease. There's some very interesting emerging data that I'm sure you've read that long-term enzyme-inducing anti-seizure medications can increase cardiovascular disease, which becomes evident at about the 10-year mark. And having chronic epilepsy, many of our patients in this study would fall into this box. It is unclear, however, the contribution of such medications towards arrhythmias. But I think reassuringly, most patients in our study who are on sodium channel blockers long term did not have clinically significant cardiac arrhythmias.
And so, in light of all this, what exactly should we be telling our epilepsy patients in clinic about cardiac risks? For example, when starting a new medication or, seeing a patient newly diagnosed with epilepsy, there's increased incidence of cardiovascular disease in people with epilepsy, but as we've been discussing, the data isn't entirely clear. So, What exactly do you say to your patients about their cardiac risks?
I think what's emerging is that patients with epilepsy do tend to have an increased risk of cardiac arrhythmias, but also cardiovascular disease. Cardiac arrhythmias in epilepsy are common. Most are benign changes, which is reassuring. However, some of the more serious cardiac arrhythmias, such as those found in this study, can quite often be overlooked, as it's quite challenging to disentangle symptoms of seizures and cardiac arrhythmias, particularly when there's loss of consciousness. Postictal arrhythmias are generally the ones we worry about because it's associated with a high mortality rate. However, seizure control appears to be the most effective way of addressing this. But where this isn't feasible, cardiology intervention should be considered on a case-by-case basis.
So let's assume after this interview, you go back to your lab and a curious student asks you to summarize the importance of your paper. For instance, why did it get published and how did that change patient care? And for which patients might it change care? So how would you answer that question?
We found that implantation of cardiac monitors in this patient population had a detection rate of about 10% for serious cardiac arrhythmias requiring urgent cardiologist management or care. Concerningly, these went undetected from both routine epilepsy and cardiac investigations. So both video EEG monitoring, which was performed as an inpatient, as well as a routine 12-lead ECG. Serious cardiac arrhythmias, when they occurred in relation to a seizure, occurred with both tonic-clonic seizures and focal impaired awareness seizures. Our novel finding of recurrent polymorphic ventricular tachycardia in a patient with an epileptic encephalopathy may highlight a potential mechanism for ventricular fibrillation, sudden death in patients with this condition who are known to have an increased incidence of SUDEP. Early intervention and/or treatment may prevent premature mortality in such patients, and where possible, seizure control should be optimized in such patients.
Again, I've been speaking with Shovi Sivathambu about her recent publication in Neurology titled Serious Cardiac Arrhythmias Detected by Subcutaneous Long-Term Cardiac Monitors in Patients with Drug-Resistant Epilepsy. You can find the full article in this week's issue of Neurology. Shovi, again, thank you so much for sharing your work with us today.
You're most welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
This is Stacey Clardy, your podcast editor. We love bringing you practical, relevant, and timely neurologic education around the world, wherever you are, for free. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll continue to join us twice a week, every week. The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.